Okay, now with the beginning hassles done, I think we are up and running with the recording and so on. So sorry about yesterday. I had to cancel the lecture, but luckily you students still here, and the recording will be available in Moodle after this. And then there's some stuff happening in the Moodle. So there's the group work topics you can already reserve, and some people have reserved. Then the ICP OS demonstration are also there, so you can book your time when you are coming. So there are four slots for the ICP OS demonstrations. If there is a need for a fifth one, I will be doing that. So I will add that if it seems that more people are coming than there is slots for the demonstrations. But we will have those ICP OS demonstrations in the following 2 weeks. And the home exam, that's also there, and you will return it this week. And if you have questions about the home exam, I'm happy to answer, so after the lecture or tomorrow. But please don't fill my email with questions about it. I would, if you can avoid it, so please after the lectures or so it would be easier to respond to them live than with email. Yeah. Then on to today's topic. So ICP OS theory a little bit. So let's see what the instrument actually does and how it's built up and what it's based on. This might be actually the most like chemistry related or theory related lecture in this course. So ICP OS is built up of a sample introduction system seen here on the left, plasma, and then optics. And if we take a closer look at the sample introduction system, the sample, so our The sample which we are analyzing, we are pumping it using a pump to the nebulizer. You can see the pump here, samples here, and the sample is being pumped into here. The nebulizer is here. An aerosol is formed from the sample, and large droplets are removed in the spray chamber. We don't want anything but very small droplets. And the carrier gas, which is argon gas, will take our sample, small sample droplets into the plasma torch, which you can see here. So only fine aerosol goes into the plasma, of course, not to turn it off, because if you would insert a lot of liquid into your plasma, it would shut down. So you need to have fine aerosol in the plasma. Then about the plasma, sorry about the Finnish picture. I have an English one coming up in the following slides. So the plasma part of the equipment, so that's the heart of the instrument. The sample is dried, atomized, and partly ionized in the plasma. And the atoms and ions are excited. And when the excitation state is released or discharged, we will see a characteristic emission for each element. So that's how we differentiate each element from each other. So with the emission and the wavelength that it has. Then about the optics, the wavelengths are separated from each other in the optics. And the light goes to the detectors. We usually have two detectors, UV and VIS detector for UV light and visible light, separate ones. And the amount of photons is counted when we get, and then we get the electronic signal for our sample. So that's a very short summary of how it works, but then we will take a closer look at each of the steps and how a little bit more about the details. The sample introduction is the first part, actually, in most cases, that's the most important and can cause significant errors in your analysis if it's not working correctly. So, if this is not in order, nothing will be in your analysis because this is the first step. This needs to be working correctly. So, we have a peristaltic pump and it feeds the sample to the nebulizer. The peristaltic pump is usually operating at the flow rate of 1 milliliter per minute. And we can increase or decrease this flow rate according to our needs. Sometimes a pump is not always needed. The concentric nebulizers, I will talk a little bit more on those. They will suck. I don't know if this is a good translation. They siphon maybe the sample by means of a Venturi effect. So they don't necessarily need the pump, but we actually always use a pump in ICB, always, at least in our laboratories, because it has some advantages. Because it, when you have the viscosity differences between samples, between calibration standards, it stabilizes or equalizes those differences. But it causes some disadvantages also, so some pulsation can be happening because of the peristaltic pump into the sample flow rate. Then the nebulizer, so when we have the sample at the nebulizer, we form a fine aerosol from the sample. And I don't know, pneumatic nebulizers are the most common ones. Ultrasonic nebulizers can also be used, but this pneumatic nebulizer just means that it's the aerosol is formed using a pressurized gas flow to form the droplets. So we have a carrier gas of argon, and it disperses the sample into a fine aerosol. The carrier gas flow rate that we use is about 1 liter per minute. We can change this also. And the most common types of nebulizers are concentric, parallel path, cross flow, and microflow nebulizers. And here are some examples of those. So you can see more in more detail. A concentric nebulizer is here. So our sample comes here and goes via the inner tube. Here, and argon gas comes here and it flows in the outside of the sample today. And here we have a very small orifice where the sample goes. So it's forced through a small orifice and the argon gas then pneumatically disperses the sample. And because this concentric nebulizer has a very, very small orifice or a small capillary tube which the sample goes through, it needs to have very clean solutions or clean sample solutions, not to block it, because this starts to block very easily. So if you have solids in your samples, this is not the best way to go about it. In the picture, actually, this sample capillary is actually quite wide, I think, for visual purposes, but I can show you when we are at the instruments, the capillary is super, super small. It's super thin, so it will block very easily. Then for dirtier samples, you can use a cross flow nebulizer or a parallel path nebulizer. Here you can see cross flow is as it sounds. So sample comes here, argon gas comes here, and they cross the paths cross each other, and the sample is nebulized using that system. And here the sample has a quite wide tube which it travels through, so we won't have easily any problems with blocking. Similarly, with parallel path, we can analyze higher solids samples. So here I have to zoom in or go closer so I see. So here actually the sample line is outside here where the sample is actually going through quite a wide space and the gas goes through a fine orifice here. So we won't have easily problems with the sample blocking this parallel path system either. So those are the most common types of nebulizers. You will see those in the ICP demonstrations, at least the ones that you are using when you go to the instrument. Then spray chamber, that's the next part of the system. So we need to select the appropriate droplets. So we don't want the large droplets. We need to get rid of them. We want only the small ones. And this is to keep the plasma stable. And spray chamber also smooths out pulses caused by the pump. So when a peristaltic pump, it little bit like presses the sample as it goes. So it causes some pulsation, but when it goes to the spray chamber, when we can get rid of that because the sample will be traveling through the spray chamber. Large droplets collide with the walls of the spray chamber and they exit to the waste container. Only the small droplets will travel with the gas flow into the plasma. The most common ones are cyclonic spray chamber and a Scott double pass spray chamber, sorry, Scott spray chamber, and both are available in single pass and double pass configurations, which actually means, okay, I'm not going to explain it now, but I'm going to show you what these are like. So this is cyclonic spray chamber, and here you would have the nebulizer, and the aerosol is formed here, and then it goes into this cyclonic spray chamber. And as the term would suggest, the cyclonic spray chamber is forming a cyclone. So the sample is traveling using a circular movement through the spray chamber. So it travels in circles here. And when we get the larger droplets, they exit into the waste, and only the fine aerosol is then going up to the plasma here. So that's the idea. And this is a single pass, so it doesn't have any more equipment inside the spray chamber, but if we had a double pass spray chamber, we would have an inner tube here. So that just means that the sample has to even go through the inner tube to access the plasma. But this is a single pass option here. Here we can see a double pass, Scott double pass spray chamber. So sample is coming from here, from the inner tube, and then going to the waste at the bottom. But here we have a double pass configuration, so the sample actually has to travel. This is the wall of the spray chamber, so it actually goes into the bottom here and then back up here. So it has to travel quite a long distance to enter the plasma. Yeah. But in most cases nowadays, we use this cyclonic single pass. And if we have dirty samples or we want to restrict the sample which goes into the plasma, we will use the double pass configuration of this cyclonic spray chamber. So we will have an inner tube here. So it restricts the amount of liquid or aerosol going into the plasma. So the single pass and double pass are just how much sample is going to the plasma. If we want to restrict the amount of sample going to the plasma, we will use this double pass. Otherwise, we will use single pass configuration. But this, of course, will have more sensitivity because more sample is going to the blood. Then about the plasma itself. So now we have fine droplets and they are going into the plasma. What happens in the plasma itself? We have this is the English one, nice. So we have the plasma torch here. The plasma is formed into the torch using an induction coil and a radio frequency power source. And we will need like 1 to 1.5 kilowatts of power to get this system going. So we will need some power to use this plasma torch. And how we do it, we have an oscillating alternating current at radio frequency, which is coupled to the induction coil, usually with the power of 1000 to 1500 watts. And this is forming a magnetic field into the plasma torch. So we can see induction coils here. You will see at the instrument in more details. So we can see here induction coils. We can use, actually our instruments don't even use, I will draw up a figure for you to see. So the plasma torch is here. Sample comes from here. So this is our torch, it's made of quartz, and if we have a coil, it just means a copper coil which circulates around our torch, but our instruments actually are using flat plate technology, so they have flat plates which are forming the magnetic field. So there are different technologies on how to get the plasma going. Different, we have Perkinelmer instruments, they usually use this flat plate technology, but other instruments, I think it's patented by Perkinelmer, so other instruments will use this induction coil made of copper. Okay, then we have a magnetic field. We have built it up using this radio frequency, oscillating alternating current, and we have argon gas going through. So argon gas is going through here, and the magnetic field is built up here. Then we need a high energy spark, which starts the plasma. So when we put the plasma on, when we turn it on, we will have the gas flows flowing, and then we ignite the plasma. So we will put in this spark, which removes electrons from argon atoms, and it causes ionization as a chain reaction, so the argon plasma is formed. And what a plasma actually is, it's ionized argon gas. So it's not a flame, a normal flame, but it's ionized gas. So that's the definition of plasma. And using this plasma, we can then atomize, ionize, and excite our analytes and then form the emission. Okay, and then our sample comes from here. So using an injector, it's inside the plasma torch, and our sample is carried by the carrier gas, so it comes into the plasma. We have three different gas streams passing through the plasma torch. So we are maintaining the plasma using a plasma gas, 8 to 16 liters per minute. Using this configuration, which we have the induction coil, we need to use 16 liters per minute of argon gas. But with the flat plates that we have in our instruments, we can use 8 liters per minute. So it's more cost effective to have that configuration because we have less argon gas consumption. Then we have the nebulizer or carrier gas, which introduces the sample into our plasma, maybe 0.8 liters per minute. And then auxiliary gas, which keeps the plasma away from the torch, because this is a quartz torch. It cannot tolerate the temperatures of the plasma, which is, I should have maybe put it here somewhere, but it's like 8,000 kelvins, 8 to 9,000 kelvins. So that's basically the temperature of the sun. So you wouldn't want your quartz torch to be in touch with the plasma. The plasma resides in a way so it doesn't touch our plasma torch because it wouldn't survive the temperatures. And we have melted a couple of torches. Sometimes it happens that the torches melt if we have maybe somehow incorrectly. We have done some maintenance and we have put the systems incorrectly, so we could melt the torch if it touches the plasma. Then about the reactions in the plasma. Sorry about this. This isn't finished, but I will explain in English. So the first process happening is the sample dries out, so the solvent evaporates. Bonds are broken, so if there's molecular stuff happening, they are broken. Atoms are also, so we are atomizing, so and the molecules form atoms. So if we want to have molecular information, that's not happening here because every molecule is broken down and we are at the atomic state. So this is an elemental analysis. That's why it's that way, because we are breaking down everything in the plasma. Then the atoms are ionized depending on their ionization energy. So as I mentioned, ionization happens partly because argon cannot ionize every element in the periodic table because it has a ionization energy of 15.76 electron volts, so it can ionize elements which has less ionization energy than the argon itself. When it collides with other atoms, it can ionize below 15.7 electron volts. Then these atoms and ions are excited to a higher energy states, and this short-term excitation state is released, and then we will have this emission. And the energy that is emitted is going according to this equation. So we are determining the elements according to their wavelengths, so we can identify according to the wavelengths of each element. So the amount of energy that is released during the emission, we can identify the element. So the radiation is characteristic for each element. Then we can have both atomic lines and ionic lines. So whether emission is happening from an atomic state or from ionic state, it depends. So we have both kind of emissions happening in the ICP-OS. So if we take a look at this is the basic state of the atom. Perustila. Does anyone know the English translation? Basic state of the atom, I would say. So, and here is when we have the ion state. So ionization is happening when our atom is ionized, and we can have different routes where the emission is happening because there are different states here, and the ionization or the emission can happen through different emissions. So we have for this is for E one element only. So we can see different kind of emissions happening for this one element only. And you can imagine when we have a lot of elements for one only, we have several emissions that can happen. And when we have a whole lot of elements in our sample, we will have very, very rich emission spectrum. So that's one of the perks of ICP-OS. So we have several wavelengths to select from, but on the other hand, we will have lots of spectral overlaps in ICP-OS because of this phenomenon. And we will see radiation in the UV, so 190 to 380 nanometers range, and for the visible light, 380 to 900 nanometers is the range which we can analyze with the ICP-OS. So we have two detectors for both of these. Two detectors, one for UV light and one for visible light in the instrument. And actually, because we can see the visible light ourselves also. So if you would analyze, let's say, sodium, it's approximately at the 9, at the 400 nanometer range, the emission line of sodium. So if you have a lot of sodium, you will see like an orange glow in the plasma. So if you're very handy, you can say, okay, my sample, just looking at the plasma, my sample has some sodium. And also some of the lanthanides also do this. So they have a greenish tone. They cause a greenish tone to the plasma if there's a lot of it. Yeah, as I mentioned, the spectra is very complex due to multiple excitation states and emission. Okay, then we can analyze our emission from the plasma using different plasma views, so we can view the plasma from different directions. So we have a plasma torch here. Sample is coming from here and into the plasma, and when we have an axial plasma, we are measuring parallel to the torch, so head on from the torch, and when we have a radial measurement, we are analyzing from the side of the torch. And this is because when we do axial measurements, we are analyzing head on from the plasma, so we can view the signal as long as it travels through the plasma torch. So that's quite a long way that we can. Or we can see the signal for a long while. So this results in more sensitivity. So this is 10 times more sensitive than radial measurement. But it has some drawbacks also because it measures the cold spots in the plasma, so there's more interference. So in the cold spots of the plasma, we can form different interference species. So we wouldn't actually want to analyze them, but in the axial view, that's happening, and we cannot help it. Then if we do the radial view, so from the side of the plasma, the sample goes through more rapidly, so less sensitivity, but it has a wider linear range. And the measurement is more stable because we are not analyzing the cold spots of the plasma, only the analytical parts of the plasma. Most modern instruments, as our instruments also, they can measure both directions using this dual view. So we can even do it so that we have both axial and radial view in our method if we want to check what is the difference between the two. If we want to have more sensitivity, but we are worried that there might be some interference, we can compare the two viewing methods to each other. Yeah, and this picture actually shows because this is done using mirrors. So the axial view is quite simple from the head-on of the plasma or from the side of the plasma, but it's done in the instrument using all kinds of mirrors and motors and so on. So it actually looks a lot more difficult in the picture than it actually is. Then about the optics. So now we have our sample. It's in. We have some emission happening. So what are we going to do with this emission? We have two options. So simultaneous measurement or sequential measurement, and both our instrument are simultaneous instruments which measure the whole spectrum at once. So all at once. This is really, really popular. So very, very few laboratories use this sequential measurement. But this has some drawbacks. The wavelengths that are used are predetermined by the manufacturer. So we can select ourselves, okay, this has emission line somewhere there, I want to use it, but it has some wavelengths, and we can choose from those 2 to 6 wavelengths for each element, at least our instrument has. And yeah, if you have something that's not in your list, you cannot help it. But usually from the 2 or 6 wavelengths, we can find a suitable wavelength in most cases. This is mostly based on the Echelle. Echelle mode, HeLa. Grating, Echelle grating, is it? Yeah, okay, moving on. I think it's Echelle grating in English, where the light is divided into different orders of magnitude and passed on to a prism that separates the wavelengths from each other. So we have a, yeah, it's basically a grating, which where the light goes. Then it's separated into different orders, and then these are going into a prism, which further separates the wavelengths from each other. Then we have the sequential device. The measurement is done wavelength by wavelength, and as you can imagine, this will slow down the measurement, of course, because we're analyzing one wavelength, then another, and so on. So it will be more slow. But the user can select any wavelength. So that's the best part of the instrument. I think I know one case in Finland which has a sequential device for a very specific case, but in almost all cases, we are using simultaneous measurement. Yeah. Then the light is directed to the detector, so the electronic signal is generated there. There would be a lot of theory on all of this, but I've skipped it in this because I don't think it's very. We would need more credit for the course if we went through all of the theory. Then, what does it actually look like? You will see in the ICP OS demonstrations when you book those. But this is what it basically looks like. We have a computer which you use to operate the instrument. We have an autosampler here. So our samples are going into the autosampler and calibration solutions. So we are not usually feeding them manually into the instrument, but we have an autosampler which we operate using this computer. So we say that, okay, I have a calibration standard 1 in location 13, for example, and it will analyze from that location. And then we build up our analysis list and then just tell the instrument to analyze those. We have wash solutions. We actually have a basin for the wash solution, so that's a better way to do it than in this picture. This is just on the table, but if you have a basin, that's even better in case the bottle leaks or something happens. So we are washing the system with some kind of acid in between samples to prevent any contamination. So each sample is analyzed, then we go to washing, then next sample, and so on. So every time that the autosampler is analyzing some liquid, it will go into washing in between to prevent contamination. It's not very visible here, but here we have the sample introduction system. So peristaltic pump here. The sample goes via some capillary tubing into the pump. Then we have spray chamber here, nebulizer, and here you can see actually the plasma. So this is a vertical plasma, so the plasma is in a vertical position, and the sample goes up in here into the plasma. And you can see it as this green flame. It's not a flame, but the green plasma in the figure. Then we have the optics where the wavelengths are separated from each other. This will need gas connections. We are using argon gas and a power line here to, of course, give us the 1.5 kilowatts that we need to operate the instrument. Then in the plasma, we will have some exhaust fumes, of course, from our sample. So we need some kind of ventilation here. This is the exhaust tube, is directly connected into the plasma chamber. So we are getting rid of any exhausts happening in the plasma chamber. Then an important point, the spray chamber will get rid of the large droplets, and they will exit into the waste container here. So we will need a big enough waste container and need to check it now and then so it's not overflowing or anything. Then lastly, chiller. We will need a chiller to cool down also the plasma chamber, so it produces quite a lot of energy, heat. So the plasma is cooled using this is a water cooling system. So it's a water cooling, and also in the optics, we are cooling the optics also during the analysis. So a chiller is an important part of this system. And this also causes quite a lot of heating into the room where the ICP is located in. So this needs to be taken into account when we are building up a laboratory for ICP OS instruments. So we need some kind of exhaust, chilling, and temperature control so the room doesn't warm up too much, and then gas connections, power line, and so on. Then a little bit about choosing the measurement conditions, how to analyze your samples. So different types of samples or analytes will require different measurement conditions. And here it's very important to know how the sample is prepared and what it contains. So we come back to the first lecture's thing. So we need to know what is in our sample to analyze it properly. And what we usually do for all our unknown samples, we do a preliminary semi-quantitative analysis, which helps in the planning of our analysis. So we do a basic calibration using multi-element standards, and it doesn't really hurt if our samples don't fit into the calibration range exactly. So we have just the calibration of a blank solution and 10 milligrams per liter of these multi-element standards. And we analyze our samples using that method, and we see the approximate amount of our analytes in the sample. And that's how we can then choose what our own analysis will be like. So the correct calibration range and so on. But this is what we very often do. So we do semi-quantitative analysis. So that semi-quantum, if they don't exactly fit our calibration range, and because we only have two calibration standards, so the Planck and 10 milligrams per liter, so that's not exactly best quantitative analysis if you have only two Planck solutions. You will get a good correlation though. The correlation coefficient will be one if you have two standards only. Okay, then because we have different sample introduction systems, how to choose the correct one? We have yes, some kind of example on how to do the selection. So we have aqueous solutions here. If we need high sensitivity, we could use different kind of hydrogenation or ultrasonic nebulization, but we have done this hydrogenation, but we don't commonly use these. But if we have quite a lot of solids in our samples, so dissolved solids, we mostly use this parallel path nebulizer or the cross flow nebulizer. And if we have no solids, so we have just aqueous samples, no solids dissolved, we can use this concentric nebulizer, which is for the cleaner samples, and cyclonic spray chamber. Yeah, so we need to know the sample background. Usually we use glass in the sample introduction system, but if we have HF, hydrofluoric acid, or bases, the glassware doesn't like it so much. So in that case, we have Teflon sample introduction system. If you want to analyze organic sample, that's also possible. We very rarely do this. We have done a few demonstrations for customers when we had organic samples, so they are in some kind of organic medium, but it will need a fully dedicated sample introduction system and a torch, because if you try to use the same system, your organics might be okay, but then when you going back to the aqueous system, you probably won't be able to light up your torch. The plasma won't ignite and so on, so you will have some problems. And in addition, you will, of course, because you're having organic samples, your calibration standards need to be in organic medium, so they are really a little bit tricky to find these organic calibration standards. And at least we don't, they are doing it in very commonly, for instance, in Neste, Finnish company, but we haven't done it so much that we would do it in a routine basis. But in some laboratories, it's working just fine. And even they have different instruments for different samples. So this is ICP-OS for organic samples, this ICP-OS for aqueous samples. So that's working actually really well if a dedicated ICP-OS can be selected for the organic analysis or the organic samples. Yeah, but it's quite easy to think that if you have clean samples, use a concentric nebulizer and cyclonic spray chamber. If you have a dirty sample, parallel path nebulizer and double pass spray chamber. So this double pass means that the less sample is going into the plasma if you have dirty samples. Then about the power and gas flows, those are the operating conditions we can change in the ICP-OS. It's in most cases we just use the settings that are recommended by the manufacturer, or maybe in the laboratory we have specific values that we have seen that are okay for our purposes. So we just use those. But in some cases, it's necessary to do some optimizations. If you have a new instrument arriving to your laboratory, you can use the manufacturer operating conditions and then do some kind of different testing if this is okay for your system. But you can start from the manufacturer settings and adjust if needed. Some cases, if we buy a new sample introduction system, so we have a new nebulizer or anything, we can check that if there's some changes to the new equipment. Then in particular analysis, if we want maximum sensitivity and or the matrix is very challenging, we might do some optimizations for our analysis. And when we increase the power, we usually increase the intensity, but actually depends on whether the line that we are measuring, so the wavelength we are measuring, if it's atomic or ionic absorption line, emission line. Sorry about this. This is a translation error. Because the ion emission requires most energy. So if you are analyzing an ionic emission line or wavelength, you will most likely want to increase the power to get it more, to get it ionized more efficiently. Then the nebulizer gas flow, it's optimized for each nebulizer separately. So it depends on which kind of nebulizer you are using. So which kind of, how much gas flow you are operating with. I have a few examples here. So we have in the upper picture, we have the radio frequency power, so the power of the instrument here, and the relative intensity of these lines. And then here's aluminium, barium, and potassium, which have been analyzed. And for aluminium, you can see a very big difference in increasing the power. So the best intensity is reached when we use the highest power. And that's the more in most cases happening. Also for barium, the highest intensity is reached when we use the highest power. But for potassium, this is a different case. So actually the highest intensity is reached with the medium power here. So 1,200 watts, 1.2 kilowatts is actually causing a highest intensity here. So it might be that we are analyzing an atomic line of potassium here, and when we are introducing more power into the system, it starts the equilibrium starts to shift that we are getting more ionic species in the plasma, and that's why, because we are analyzing an atomic line, the we are decreasing its intensity because ionization is happening more efficiently here. But it depends on the case. So you can check this if you are very eager. In most cases, we don't do very specific adjustments here, but then for the nebulizer flow rate, the change is also quite big. For potassium, you can see it here measured. So when we have the highest nebulizer flow rate, so that's the flow rate of the argon gas which is nebulizing our sample. So if we have the highest nebulizer gas flow rate here, we have the highest intensity of the potassium. But for our arsenic and aluminium, actually it's increasing very rapidly at the, let's say, 0.6 liters per minute. So 0.5 would perhaps be best for aluminium and arsenic. And for copper, we can see at 0.8 reaching the highest intensity here. And What if you're analyzing all of those at the same time? Then you will just have to pick one because you cannot change the nebulizer flow rate from each element to each other, or you could, but it would be really time consuming. So you would just have to make some compromise here. So, but if you would like to, you wouldn't perhaps want to choose the one which is best for potassium because then you will have absolutely no intensity for the aluminium and arsenic, or very low intensity, actually. So maybe you would choose something 0.5 or 0.6 nebulizer gas flow from here. So you will get all of those to an acceptable intensity. Yeah. Then robust conditions, but not always we want to have the highest intensity, but the more it's more important that we are having a robust analysis. And what this means is that when we have a robust plasma, we have a it's stable to changes in the sample matrix, and the ionization and excitation are happening in an efficient manner. So if we have some small changes in the sample matrix, our plasma is not affected very much. And that's of course an ideal case. So we don't want small changes in the sample matrix to cause any major shifts in our analytical results. And in almost all cases, our samples are not exactly identical to each other, but the sample background changes a little bit. So a robust plasma is what we are looking for in most cases. And this can be described by the ratio of magnesium ionic and atomic lines. So magnesium ionic line divided by atomic line emission should be higher than 8. So you can analyze some magnesium solution using your operating conditions and check the ratio of those two lines. And if it's above 8, you're working in good, robust plasma conditions. But if you're less than 8, you might need to adjust your operating parameters. And the most important parameters that affect this are the plasma power, nebulizer gas flow rate, and sample feed rate. Maybe this not so important actually, but the plasma power and the nebulizer gas flow rate are the most important. Those are the ones that I showed in the previous picture. So you can adjust these if it seems that the plasma is not robust when you're working. In most cases, when you are using low nebulizer gas flow rate, sorry, I have a mistake here. I thought I corrected this, but I haven't. Low nebulizer gas flow, it should be, and higher power, they lead to robust conditions. So a little bit lower nebulizer flow rate and then high power. Then choice of wavelength and integration time. I think this is my last slide. So initially, when you start an analysis, you would probably want to select a few wavelengths which you can test if there is some interference, and then choose the one that you see most working most nicely in your application. There is, as I mentioned, there are several wavelengths in the instrument, and the instrument actually suggests the wavelengths in a specific order according to how much interferences it has, which is the sensitivity of that line, and so on. You could also use this Inorganic Ventures interactive periodic table, which I showed you in a previous lecture, which also shows those stability of each element, if you're interested in that. Yeah, so when you are selecting wavelengths, you need to have appropriate sensitivity, no spectral interferences. That's the ideal case. If you're working with pure sample backgrounds, you most likely will be having even several choices, so you can select from one or two good wavelengths, and the spectral interferences will not be very problematic. But if you have a very difficult sample matrix, it can be that you won't even find an interference-free wavelengths, but you will just have to take one that is most appropriate for your sample, and maybe do some interference correction if you can see some interference. If you take, let's say, four wavelengths to start the analysis, then choose one or two that you want to use. You can delete the other ones from your method, so no need to keep a zillion of wavelengths in your method after you have selected the correct one, or maybe two if you want to keep two in your method. Then, if you want to analyze low concentrations, you would like to use radio measurements because that's more sensitive. If you have very, very low concentrations, you can also increase the integration time, and that's the time that the instrument collects the signal. It's usually from 1 to 10 seconds. So if you are working close to the LOD or LOQ and seem to have problems reaching the appropriate sensitivity, you can increase this integration time for some elements, maybe arsenic or lead or some kind of heavy metal that you would like to see very low concentrations of mercury, for instance. So you can increase this up to maybe even 15 seconds. So you can increase the time that the signal is read. Stop very suddenly. Okay. That was actually my slides today. So if you have some questions, I think a lot of theory. Luckily, my lecture wasn't longer than because it's a lot of stuff. So you can come back to those issues, maybe take a look at the slides. To maybe fully understand these issues. Do you have any questions? Yeah, if no questions, I'm going to stop the recording, and if you have something to ask about the course, I'm here to answer any questions about the home exam exercises, anything. I will put the model answers to the exercises to during today or tomorrow because I haven't translated them yet. So I will be putting the model answers to the to Moodle also.